This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Jonah Hill became famous for playing a high school student in the comedy Superbad. That was just one of his comedy films, along with The 40-Year-Old Virgin, Knocked Up, and Funny People, that was produced and or directed by Judd Apatow. Hill received Oscar nominations for Best Supporting Actor for his dramatic roles in Moneyball and The Wolf of Wall Street. This year, he co-starred in the Gus Van Sant film Don't Worry, He Won't Get Far on Foot, and he stars with Emma Stone in the new Netflix series Maniac. Jonah Hill just made his directing debut with the new film Mid-90s, which he also wrote. It's about a subculture of skateboarders in the mid-1990s, the period when Jonah Hill was a self-described not-great skateboarder, but hung out with a group of much better skateboarders. The film isn't autobiographical, but it draws on his memories. The film is told from the point of view of a boy, played by the 11-year-old Sonny Solchick, who wants to be a skateboarder and be accepted by the older skaters he admires, who take life-threatening risks with skate tricks and stunts, and spend the rest of their time smoking, drinking, and trash-talking. The skaters are played by pros, but the skaters they play are unlikely to get anywhere. They have no money, no connections. Jonah Hill, welcome to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the movie. What did skateboarding mean to you when you were in your teens?
I'm no ambassador for skateboarding, and skateboarding is so sensitive to being portrayed in film by outsiders, and that's understandable because it's often butchered. But when I was maybe 9 or so, skateboarding gave me a real sense of, and especially more in my early teens, gave me a real sense of community outside of my home. And I think a lens that I ended up seeing a lot of life through, which is, you know, taste in music, clothes, the treatment of authority, and just a sense of perverse closeness. I don't know, it just laid an imprint on me.
So the group of skaters who you were friends with or aspired to be friends with, what was that culture like?
It was a lot of different things. You know, I was always terrible. I always wanted to be great. I think I still would trade a lot of achievements for certain skateboarding achievements that just I don't think are physically possible for me at this point at 34. I filmed a lot.
Oh, you filmed the skaters. Was that your in? Like, you weren't going to be a great skateboarder, but you could
document
them? No,
yes, exactly.
Okay.
And I loved it. And it was, there were such bombastic personalities, such twisted sense of humor. Now, with a 20-year lens on it, having written this film, it really showed me, you know, a lot of what I think was great about it and what are things that I had to, and people from that time had to unlearn.
What are some of the things you felt you had to unlearn from that culture?
The way people spoke to one another and what they said to one another, especially in regards to homophobia and toxic masculinity.
Like, there's a scene where the kid in the movie says to the slightly older kid, "Thank you," and the other kid says, "Oh, that's so gay. You can't say that." And then he starts...
He says, "Don't thank people because people are going to think you're gay."
Yeah.
And the idea is that is something that a kid would have said to another kid, but how absurd and messed up is that, that that was the mentality or wasn't blinked at when things like that were said back then? That was a choice I made. Some of the language is really hard to watch for me. Some of the actions are really hard to watch for me. But ultimately, I felt it was more unfair to rewrite history than to show it as bluntly and as uncomfortable as it was.
A lot of humor is like self-deprecating humor, and self-deprecating humor doesn't go over in that kind of like teen masculine, like athletic culture. I say this as an outsider to all of that. but anyways, did you have an impulse towards self-deprecating humor but knew that that wouldn't be appropriate to the scene that you were in?
I think my point is, I'm talking even in my 20s, even going through a career publicly, going through my 20s publicly, either being mean and defensive or self-deprecating to a point where you're beating yourself up to feel like you deserve a seat at the table are both unhealthy for me. Because obviously being mean makes you feel bad when you go home if you have a heart, which I do, and then and being defensive or beating yourself up gives you a real problem with your self-esteem. And the way I related that in mid-90s or tried to express that within the character of Stevie is this person's currency in his life is his ability to take abuse and to take pain. And I don't want to give away the end of the film, but the film, along with my own journey, has been a tremendous amount about self-acceptance.
Though his issues are different than yours, and his way of resolving it is different than yours, but that's the core emotional issue that you're getting at.
Yeah, is that we all beat ourselves up. I explore male self-abuse in the film. It was something that I found, after doing a lot of research, very troubling and fascinating. Literal sibling abuse, troubling and fascinating. And why skateboarding is a natural draw to someone who takes hits, whether inflicted from someone else or themselves.
Why do you think it's a natural draw for somebody in that position?
Because to be great at skateboarding, you have to be willing to slam on your face down 10 stairs on concrete over and over and over and over and over again. And there's something punishing about that and self-punishing about that. And there's a great reward that is truly earned, even if it's just for you.
Were you willing to do that when you wanted to skate?
Very briefly, in a time where I think I invited pain. But I quickly grew out of inviting physical pain in my life and more emotional pain to follow.
Good for you. Yeah,
The only scars were inside. And just a general recklessness, which I related to, and I related to this kid's loneliness. And so even though this isn't my story, I wanted to show someone going through deep pain and a real sense of hope through community, even if that community has deep flaws to it, like small-mindedness, prejudice, misogyny, that for this kid, it still provided something hopeful. And perhaps these young men will grow up and unlearn some of this stuff.
Would you have a dream of getting on a skateboard now?
Yeah, I dream about it every night. I honestly, Terry, when I tell you, I would trade a lot in my life to be able to do certain tricks.
Right. Okay, I shouldn't have used the word dream. Would you in reality ever consider getting on a skateboard now?
I landed a kickflip in front of our cast and crew in order just, A, out of being so excited and exhilarated by everyone skating, but B, to just prove that this is something that at one point was a massive part of my life.
What are some of the movies that were beyond your age as a kid that your parents let you watch because you loved movies so much?
I'll tell you a story that I find interesting because, I mean, I saw everything. I devoured film. Like, I continue to. I love it. So I had ran through so many films, and I would go to the newsstand, and you know when your parents take you to the magazine stand when you're a kid and you flip through magazines, or if there's a magazine stand on the corner and they're at another place or something, I would look through the film magazines. I was just so interested. So I would ask them often, can I see this film? Can I see this film? And most of the time they say yes. So basically it came down to two films that I wasn't allowed to see. They said, we are so lenient. You don't even realize how lucky you are. You cannot see Kids and you cannot see A Clockwork Orange.
Wow. Kids is all about kids similar to the kids in your movie.
And it's a seminal movie in my life. Kids was a huge influence on me as a filmmaker. But this film is in the opposite of Kids, where Kids is so beautiful in its nihilism, and it's the world ending tomorrow, burn the world down. And this film, mid-90s, is all about connection and hope, even if it's dysfunctional connection and hope. And those were the two movies I wasn't allowed to see. So, of course, I made it my mission to see both of them right away. I think I was 11 or 12.
How did you do it?
A friend of mine who I skateboarded with, who was older, had both cassettes at his house. And I saw Kids, and I was like, I love skateboarding. I love New York. This is about kids skateboarding in New York. I completely was too young to understand the AIDS subplot, or main plot, I guess. And so I completely wasn't affected by that. So I was just like, this is the greatest movie I've ever seen in my life. It wasn't until I was older that I understood the HIV/AIDS plot mm-hmm. part of the film because mm-hmm. it went over my head. So I just took, wow, this is subversive and this is dangerous, you know? And then I saw Clockwork Orange and I had to go to my parents like a shell of a child and be like, you were right. I saw it. I'm deeply disturbed and I need to talk to you because I was like, you know, like the last thing I wanted to do was tell them that I disobeyed them, but I was too shook up not to speak to them about what I had seen.
What shook you up the most about the film?
I think the rape and ultraviolence was just too, of course, it was too heavy. It was so, so hard to watch as an adult, let alone a kid.
What did your parents say to reassure you?
Well, first of all, they were like, you should listen to us because we're telling you this stuff for a reason.
Yeah.
And then I, of course, didn't for many, many years and realized they were trying their best. I think ultimately it did make me braver as an artist in life because I do think about that. And I think ultimately there's something about me that draws me to things that are difficult and maybe I'm uncomfortable with comfort. And I think my acting career says that when I really dissect it as well.
My guest is Jonah Hill. He wrote and directed the new film Mid-90s about a group of skateboarders in the mid-1990s. We'll talk more after a break, and Maureen Carrigan will review a new collection of Eleanor Roosevelt's advice columns. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to my interview with Jonah Hill. He became famous for playing a high school student in the comedy Superbad. He was in several other films produced and or directed by Judd Apatow. He received Oscar nominations for Best Supporting Actor for his dramatic roles in Moneyball and The Wolf of Wall Street. He stars with Emma Stone in the new Netflix series Maniac, and he's just made his directing debut with the new film Mid-90s, which he also wrote. It's about a subculture of skateboarders in the mid-1990s, the period when Jonah Hill was skateboarding. So we were talking about loving movies, wanting to write and to direct. How did you start acting, and how old were you when you started to realize not only you wanted to do it, but that you were good at it?
Well, I think they're two very different answers to that question. My goal my whole life was to be a writer and director. To say this is a dream, what's happening now is like an understatement. And when I went to New School in New York, I would write these one-act plays and we would often put them up at bars. And when I would have actors read, I had really bad bedside manner because I didn't understand why they wouldn't do it in the way that you wrote it. And my friend pulled me aside really generously as a good friend and was like, look, like you need to learn how to talk to actors. They don't like auditioning, you know, and they don't like working with you. And so I took an acting class to learn how I'd want to be spoken to as an actor. So maybe I could speak more eloquently and lovingly towards actors. And I was such an insecure person that I got such positive feedback in the acting class that it derailed me for 16 years. and in this amazing derailment, in this amazing education in film and film school, and also finding a new expression that is another creative expression that I love.
Well, that's so interesting that you really wanted to direct and you took the acting class just to learn how to speak better to actors. That's weird. That's crazy. That's interesting.
A compliment can reroute you for 16 years. you find the right compliment for the right insecure person and it could change a life.
Did you agree that you were good?
Yes. I struggle with taking compliments. My instinct is to make a joke or say no. But where I'm at in my life is I don't really want to be so negative towards myself and try and be kind to myself. And the truth is I did think I was good at acting.
Mm-hmm. And then is it fair to say that you kind of found a different kind of tribe than the skateboarding tribe, that you found like maybe your real tribe with Judd Apatow's circle of actors and writers? Even though you weren't in Freaks and Geeks, you were in so many Judd Apatow directed or produced movies. How did you become part of the Judd Apatow tribe?
Well, I met, actually, the casting director I hired on mid-90s, Allison Jones, is Judd's casting director. And that's why I hired her for my first film, because she's the one who introduced me to Judd. After I did I Heart Huckabees, I met some casting directors because, you know, I got like an agent off of that. And then Allison introduced me to Judd and brought me in to read for that little one line in 40-Year-Old Virgin. And I don't know, then I stuck around.
So there's one specific line I'm going to ask you about, because this line fits so well with what we were talking about before, about having to unlearn a kind of masculinity and attitude that you had learned in skateboard culture. And you might be able to guess the line I'm going to ask you about. So it's from Superbad, which you start in with Michael Cera. And you're a high school kid in this, and you know you're not part of the cool crowd at all. And one of the really popular high school girls, played by Emma Stone, who you now co-star with in the Netflix series Maniac.
I love her.
From a distance, I love her too. From the distance
she's
of an audience seat.
She's just as wonderful as a person as she is an actor.
Good, good, good. That always makes me happy to hear. But anyway, she's going to be throwing a party while her parents are gone. And she needs somebody to buy alcohol. And even though you're underage, you decide you're going to get the alcohol, you know, bring it to the party and be the hero. And so you're trying to tell the Michael Cera character about this. And he's kind of skeptical that this is a very good idea, that you'll even be able to do it. And then you say, and I'm going to say like the really clean version of this, because it's much too expletive-laced for us to play this on the radio, but you basically say, you know how girls say I was so drunk last night I shouldn't have had sex with that guy? We could be that mistake. So, gosh, how does that sound to you now? I mean, women are so furious about how teenage boys and adult men try to get girls and women drunk or drugged to get them into bed.
I mean, it's literally horrifying. What a hard thing to hear, because the idea behind that is this young man is hoping the young woman is so inebriated that her judgment would be so poor that she would make a mistake by sleeping with him. And that is incredibly wrong. And I didn't write that film, so I think comedy has a really hard time in the aging process, because things that are funny at a moment or people might laugh at, as times change, that was never right. But it, for some reason, it was okay to make a joke about it at that point, whereas, of course, it's not now. Hearing it now sounds horrific. So, how does it sound to you?
Awful. But it didn't sound good to me then either. I didn't like the idea, you know, that kind of like disregard for girls or women, just like that never sounded
good.
It's
upsetting, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's deeply upsetting. You know what, to be honest with you, I was 23 and not that that's an excuse, but I don't think I had the emotional maturity to understand that those words or that joke would be so horrible, you know, because that's the reality. I don't think I ever thought of that as a reality because it's not my experience. And so now thinking of that as a reality is very hard to hear.
Yeah, well, thank you for being reflective about that. So so it's been interesting 13 years later after Superbad to see how you and how Judd Apatow and Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg have evolved, you know, and the subjects you've all taken on since then, because I think things have changed.
Yeah, and I literally can only speak for myself. And as an actor in that moment, I didn't see how hard that is and how ugly that joke is. But I don't want to speak for the filmmakers, because this is such a larger, hard issue where a 13-year-old joke stands now. When I hear that, it's very disturbing. But I also know those people that wrote it, and they're really good people. So it's just so complicated. I never want to be hurtful to anybody, either side.
So I'm going to play an excerpt of a Saturday Night Live sketch that you hosted in 2014. And it's the sketch that most took me by surprise. And when I say me, I mean me personally. So you played a 6-year-old who's with his stepmother at a Benihana restaurant, seated at a communal table, and you're acting like this like 6-year-old insult comic with all the insults directed at your stepmother, Dr. Debbie Wasserstein, who's played by Vanessa Bayer, and she's trying to make you stop.
That is inappropriate.
No, inappropriate is you listening to NPR on the drive over. Now my nightmares will take place in Syria and star Terry Gross. And hey, all things considered, maybe consider a kid is listening and throwing a train whistle every once in a while to hold my interest.
Okay, needless to say, I was so shocked and delighted to be name-checked by you on the show.
There's so many layers to why that is humorous to hear at this moment. It's just so funny. I think the idea of a little kid who behaves like an old insult comic, the whole thing was like, he's like an old man, but he's still a little kid. So the fact that he has to listen to NPR is incredibly boring to a kid, even though he's so aware to talk about the show with such detail and understanding. But that actually, that character came about years and years ago. I did it the first time. I hosted First for Superbad, so I was probably like 23 or something. And I was at dinner a few weeks before, randomly with Bill Hader and Andy Samberg, and I think Seth Meyers was there. And Bill Hader had told a story about going to a Benihana in his hometown, and there was a kid who he couldn't tell whether the kid was like 6 or like 40. And when the chef did his trick, the kid leaned back and clapped his one hand against the table, almost like Tony Soprano style. And I think I just started doing the kid as if he was like an old Catskills comedian. And then that's where, when I got there a few weeks later, we were like, oh, we should try that as a sketch. And then we ended up doing it a bunch of times.
Well, Jonah Hill, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's just been great to talk with you.
Thank you. You too.
Jonah Hill wrote and directed the new film Mid-90s.
Eleanor Roosevelt, widow of the great wartime president, was a mother figure not only to her large and close-knit family, but to thousands of homesick GIs and to the impoverished and underprivileged in all parts of the earth. She was 4 times the First Lady of the land and was oft proclaimed First Lady of the world.
Eleanor Roosevelt's long list of accomplishments doesn't usually include advice columnist, but for over 20 years, she did write a popular column that advised Americans on everything from the feasibility of interfaith marriages to the wisdom of the North Atlantic Pact. Some of these columns have just been collected in a book called If You Ask Me, and our book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
As an advice columnist, Eleanor Roosevelt was not especially witty nor psychologically acute. Unlike many of today's inspirational life coaches, Eleanor didn't invite her readers to accompany her on extended journeys of introspection. Indeed, when a questioner wrote to her in 1944 asking, "What did the president say to you when he proposed?" Eleanor firmly drew the curtains over that intimate subject by replying, "There are some things in life which one should be allowed to keep to oneself." But one of the things Eleanor did have going for her as a counselor and dispenser of practical wisdom was the fact that she was so real. She clearly was not performing nor winking at her readers. And she certainly wasn't checking in with a PR team before weighing in on questions ranging from the death penalty, anti, birth control, pro, and how soon a widow might begin dating again after the loss of a beloved husband. "Heavens above," Eleanor exclaimed in a column in 1946, "you can decently be seen with other men whenever you feel like going out again. This is your life." Once upon a time in America, ordinary people turned to Eleanor Roosevelt for advice. And as these columns attest, she repaid their trust with responses that are downright startling to read today because of how seriously she took even their most mundane problems. Eleanor's advice column was called If You Ask Me, and it ran first in the Ladies Home Journal and then McCall's Magazine from 1941, when of course she was still First Lady, to her death in 1962. A selection of those columns has just been published in a book also called If You Ask Me, edited by Eleanor Roosevelt scholar Mary Jo Binker. As with anything Eleanor, you have to wonder where she found the time to be a regular magazine columnist, in addition to, among other things, writing her syndicated newspaper column called My Day, holding weekly White House press conferences, traveling around the country on behalf of New Deal programs, and answering some estimated 130,000 letters a year as First Lady. The America that emerges through this 20-year sampling of Eleanor's advice column is at once familiar and very long gone. We're still wrestling, of course, with arguments over civil liberties, national health care, the Electoral College, and institutionalized racism and sexism. Eleanor gamely weighed in on those hot-button topics. But then there are a whole slew of other letters here that come out of an America so earnest it almost seems like the product of a work of speculative fiction. Imagine being a young woman in 1949 and feeling that it was okay to write to Eleanor Roosevelt to ask, "Do girls who refuse to neck ever get married?" Or the 19-year-old boy in 1946, who's already a veteran of World War II, who asks Eleanor if he's too young to marry his sweetheart. Eleanor uncharacteristically waffled on that one. Although she was, by nature and upbringing, emotionally reticent, Eleanor sometimes responded to the genuine need of her questioners with an openness that was rare then and almost unimaginable now. In 1954, Eleanor received this letter that reads, "My sister eats her heart out about mistakes she made bringing up her oldest boy. She thinks you are a great woman, Mrs. Roosevelt, and I wish you could tell her a few mistakes you think you made when your children were growing up." Eleanor wrote a long response that in part contained these raw admissions. "I gave in and allowed one of my sons to be sent to boarding school. I did not have the courage to fight the family tradition. It was a serious mistake on my part. I did too little for my three older children personally when they were babies." As trivial a cultural artifact as an advice column may seem to be, Eleanor's If You Ask Me columns reveal multitudes about the extraordinary relationship she forged with her fellow Americans of all races, young and old. There's something very democratic about this 20-plus year monthly conversation of sorts that Eleanor conducted on the pages of popular women's magazines. People felt they had a right to contact Eleanor, and she felt she had a responsibility to respond. And although seriousness was her hallmark as an advice columnist, I also get the feeling that writing these columns and consequently being more connected to the lives of everyday Americans gave Eleanor great joy.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed If You Ask Me, Essential Advice from Eleanor Roosevelt, edited by Mary Jo Binker. Coming up, we hear from Atlantic staff writer McKay Coppins. He'll talk about his article, The Man Who Broke Politics, about how Newt Gingrich pioneered the divisive political tactics used today. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
We'll be right back.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. The man who broke politics is the headline of an article about Newt Gingrich written by my guest, McKay Coppins, a staff writer for The Atlantic magazine. It's about how Newt Gingrich pioneered a style of partisan combat replete with name-calling, conspiracy theories, and strategic obstructionism that paved the way for today's divisive politics. Coppin says few figures in modern history have done more than Newt Gingrich to lay the groundwork for Trump's rise. Gingrich served in the U.S. House of Representatives as a Republican from Georgia from 1979 to 1998 and was Speaker of the House during his last 3 years in office. He remains powerful today through his appearances on Fox News and his relationship with President Trump. Trump appointed Gingrich's wife, Callista, ambassador to the Vatican. Gingrich has always used polarizing issues to rally his base. Lately, he's been warning Americans that there are threats posed by the migrant caravan heading to the Mexico-U.S. border. Here he is on Fox News on October 19th, speaking with Laura Ingraham on her show.
This is an invasion. This is an act of attacking the United States sovereignty. And the fact
right now, Mexico, and I want to thank the Mexican officials and the Mexican police who are putting their lives on the line and getting a lot of grief from leftist politicians who are happy to give Trump a pain in the you-know-what over this issue.
Well, I think actually this is the best Mexico's ever been.
Ever.
I attribute that to President Trump and Secretary Pompeo, but also I think to the Mexican government being to realize that this is going to be a crisis. You can't have thousands and thousands and thousands of people decide to break the law and have any expectation that civilization is going to withstand it.
Okay, so that was Newt Gingrich on Laura Ingraham's show. McKay Coppins, welcome to Fresh Air. So your new article is about Newt Gingrich. He just called the caravan an invasion, an act of attacking U.S. sovereignty, something civilization might not withstand. Those are frightening warnings. What has Newt Gingrich's role been in the Trump administration's crackdown on immigration and in its rhetoric about immigration?
Yeah, Newt Gingrich occupies a kind of interesting place in the president's orbit. He doesn't have an official job in the administration. His wife is the U.S. ambassador to the Holy See in Rome. But he kind of plays the role of informal advisor and, you know, constant on-air surrogate and defender of Trump. When I spoke to him earlier this year, it was before the caravan had become the issue or the wedge that it has. But he told me that he, you know, very blatantly and brazenly, he was advising Republicans in their midterm strategy was to make immigration, law and order, issues like that kind of center to the campaign. And he said that the midterm elections are going to come down to two words, Kavanaugh and caravan, is in one of the many kind of nudisms that that get picked up and circulate on social media and cable news. But I think that it's clear that he sees this as a political advantage for Republicans that they need to exploit in these final weeks of the midterm. He's kind of pushing all his chips into this one big bet.
I thought Newt Gingrich had kind of disappeared from the political scene, but apparently he's very active on Fox News and very influential on Fox News.
Yeah, it's, I think, interesting. If you're not a regular Fox News viewer, I think a lot of people probably forgot about Newt Gingrich. He's very influential with the Republican base, the Fox News audience. He's seen as kind of this iconic figure, this truth teller. And he's also, frankly, influential within the Trump administration. He talks to the White House, he told me, 10 to 15 times a week. He's on the phone with Jared Kushner or Mike Pompeo or you know, talking to Republican leaders in Congress. He is quite an influential figure, and I think that a lot of people forget about him, but I don't think we should for many reasons.
What are the reasons?
Well, for one thing, he's influential in this current Trump administration, but also his career is important to understand if you want to understand how we got to this point in our politics. He entered Congress in the 70s, and if you kind of trace the last 40 years of his career, you'll really come to understand how our politics has devolved into this kind of zero-sum culture war. You'll see the way that he pioneered a lot of the tactics of partisan warfare that we now take for granted as just a common fixture of our political landscape, but were actually important innovations by Newt Gingrich Gingrich and his allies. And more than anything, I think that if you look at the way that he gained power in the first place, he did it very deliberately and methodically by undermining the institution of Congress itself from within, by kind of blowing up the bipartisan coalitions that had existed for a long time in Washington, and then using the kind of populist anger at the gridlock in Congress to then take power. And that's a strategy we've seen replicated again and again, all the way up into 2016 when Trump was campaigning on draining the swamp. This is a strategy that may seem kind of commonplace now, but that Newt Gingrich was one of the premier architects of.
So your new article about Newt Gingrich is titled The Man Who Broke Politics. And you date his really divisive style of politics to 1978. He was running for Congress as a House representative from Georgia. He was speaking to a gathering of college Republicans. He was 35 years old, and he said, "One of the great problems we have in the Republican Party is that we don't encourage you to be nasty. We encourage you to be neat, obedient, and loyal, and faithful, and all those Boy Scout words, which would be great around the campfire, but are lousy in politics." And he told them that to be successful, they need to, quote, raise hell, to stop being so, quote, nice, and to realize that politics was, quote, a war for power. So, what insights do you have about why, before he was even in Congress, he saw that kind of raising hell, war for power approach as being like a terrific tactic?
Prior to entering Congress, Newt Gingrich had been an historian. He had a PhD in history. He was teaching history at West Georgia College. And he kind of gravitated toward heroes of war more than anything else. He loved reading war histories, World War I, World War II. One of the defining moments of his life, according to him, was when he was 15 years old and he visited a battleground in Verdun, France, with his parents, and kind of toured the grounds. And it was this kind of very macabre setting where there were, an ossuary where there were bones piled high from dead soldiers, and it was still scarred by cannon fire. And he told me that that was an important moment where he realized, in his words, that countries can die, and that it would be his role to make sure that America didn't. But it's important that he's always kind of framed his role in politics as that of, a figure in war or at battle. He doesn't kind of look to the great legislators or deal makers or politicians, for the most part, as his role models. He looks to generals and warriors. And I think that's important to understand as you watch him enter Congress in the late 70s. He was not there to kind of work in the committee structure and deal with constituent services. He was there to foment revolution and declare war, and that has always kind of been his mindset.
So when he actually took a seat in Congress in 1979, you say the Republican Party was at a low point, largely because of Watergate, and Newt's strategy was to revitalize the party. What was his plan to revitalize the party?
Well, he had a very specific plan that he was pretty candid about. He would tell everyone that he encountered about it. And at the time, they kind of dismissed him as this loudmouth freshman congressman who should remember his place. But his plan was to reclaim power for Republicans in Congress by blowing up the bipartisan coalitions that were essential to legislating, and then seizing on that dysfunction to then turn around and tell Americans, look, you need to put Republicans in charge because Congress isn't working with Democrats. It was a very cynical strategy, but he wasn't afraid of describing it. I talked to Norm Ornstein, who's a political scientist who knew Gingrich at the time, and Ornstein said that he wanted to build toward a national election where people were so disgusted by Washington that they would throw the ins out and bring the outs in. So that was his strategy from day one.
So by taking aim at moderates in the Republican Party and then helping bring in new young Republican congressmen who believed, like Newt Gingrich did, that you should try to blow up bipartisan coalitions and destroy that kind of moderate approach to Republican politics. By doing that, was he a major force in moving the Republican Party to the right?
Absolutely. And it was important how he did it, because this just isn't a story of ideology. It's also a story of kind of attitude and style and tactics. You know, most of the congressmen that Gingrich helped elect or kind of gave power to were more conservative, but they were also kind of, for lack of a better word, meaner and more aggressive and more combative and more confrontational. And that those were actually the things he looked at more than hard right ideology. He just wanted people who were willing to fight. But he did play an important role. And it's important to note the way he did it, which was basically by circumventing the traditional Republican institutions that were in charge of recruiting and grooming and supporting congressional candidates across the country. His tactic, strategy was to build his own infrastructure entirely outside of the Republican institutions. So he went out himself and raised money. He went out himself and recruited candidates. Some of the candidates that he backed were explicitly Republicans that most establishment figures in Washington did not want to see in Congress, but he didn't care. He kind of saw his role as building a new Republican Party outside of the existing infrastructure. And by doing that, he set a model for future Republican leaders and conservative bomb throwers to follow. You know, we saw most recently in the last few years, people like Ted Cruz do the same thing and kind of follow his lead. And certainly Donald Trump was able to win the Republican nomination without any institutional support at first by kind of following this same tack.
Okay, so once he recruited people to run for office, how did he train them to campaign for office?
So Gingrich had this organization called GOPAC that he used to provide training to Republican candidates who wanted to emulate Newt Gingrich. So, you know, he would send out cassette tapes and memos to these candidates, providing them with kind of attack lines and talking points, and frankly created a whole new vocabulary for this rising generation of conservatives. There was one memo I write about in the piece called Language, A Key Mechanism of Control, that literally included a list of recommended words that Republicans should use in describing Democrats. And they included words like sick, pathetic, lie, anti-flag, traitors, radical, and corrupt. So these were words, you know, the whole idea, the kind of broader strategy when waging these national campaigns was to reframe the kind of policy debates in Washington that may have seemed kind of dull or inaccessible to the average American and turn them into these big struggles between good and evil, or, you know, white hats versus black hats, and kind of, you know, a battle for the character and soul of America. And he was a master, especially of finding kind of creative wedge issues to turn into political talking points. So, for example, when Woody Allen had an affair with his partner's adoptive daughter, that might have seemed like a kind of unseemly story in pop culture or Hollywood, but Gingrich saw it as an opportunity and gave a speech saying that that Woody Allen affair fits the Democratic platform perfectly. That's just one example of how he kind of would show his kind of followers and acolytes how to politicize these stories in the news and try to turn them to Republicans' advantage. He also, I think, one thing that I came across in doing the research for this story was he was kind of an early pioneer of branding your enemies with catchy alliterative nicknames. So he would frequently call Dukakis Daffy Dukakis and, you know, say that we're running against the loony left, which clearly is a tactic that we're now familiar with, given who is in the Oval Office.
Newt Gingrich is very good at using media. And you say he believed and probably still believes that the media loves a good fight. So right. If you pick a fight, if you create a battle, that's a great way to get coverage. So what are some examples of how he did that?
Well, one of the early examples that I think helped shape his thinking on this is Gingrich recognized the potential political value in the C-SPAN cameras that had just recently been installed in the House at the time that he was kind of rising up through the ranks. And he would kind of take to the floor at the end of the day when the chamber was basically empty, and he would give these kind of thundering speeches, kind of tirades against the Democrats that were being delivered to no real audience in the actual room where he was, but that were then being beamed out to televisions across the country. And he found that the more provocative he was and the more angry he was, the more likely his speeches were to get picked up in the news. At one point, he was giving one of these speeches, and Speaker Tip O'Neill had had enough and erupted, saying that this is the lowest thing he'd seen in Congress, and kind of irate with Newt Gingrich. And that fight ended up on the nightly news, the national nightly news. And some members of Congress might have been embarrassed that this had gotten so much publicity, but Gingrich kind of knew the score and immediately declared victory. He kind of crowed to the Washington Post, look, I'm a famous person now. And I think that shows a lot about how Gingrich kind of was able to use these confrontations to his advantage.
So are there other echoes today that you see of the kind of battlefield politics that Newt Gingrich brought to politics?
Yeah, I mean, I think that certainly his tactics have lived on. The obstructionism, the name-calling. One of the early things that he did was mainstreaming conspiracy theories as part of kind of regular discourse. So, for example, when Vince Foster, a Clinton aide, committed suicide, Gingrich was one of the most prominent Republicans sort of publicly flirting with the kind of fringe conspiracy theory that he had actually been assassinated. And he saw that as a way to kind of muck up Clinton's White House and his agenda. But I think that the bigger point is the way that he turned national politics and congressional politics into, you know, team sport, right? That at the end of the day, there's no point in ever working with the other side. It's zero sum. It's them or us. You know, it's good versus evil. And the other side is corrupt. In fact, he wrote a book just recently, Newt Gingrich, in which he says outright that Trump's America is incompatible with the anti-Trump coalition's view of America. He said, one will simply defeat the other. There is no room for compromise. Trump has understood this perfectly since day one. And I think that is what's driven him to Trump. More than any ideology or shared worldview, beyond this kind of idea that we have to beat the other side and that's all that matters.
McKay Cubbins, thank you so much for talking with us.
Hey, thank you.
McKay Coppins is a staff writer for The Atlantic. His article about Newt Gingrich is titled The Man Who Broke Politics. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.